We're beginning with the first letter of Peter, chapter 2, verse 22. But I'll go back and read for you the second part that we did yesterday, because last week we only did so few verses. Peter is talking about a community that's clearly suffering, and they're suffering because of persecution. It becomes really obvious as the letter develops. But he's giving them advice about how to live in the world. And one of the things he said last week was, don't be insubordinate. Don't be anti-government just to be anti-government. It's a bit of a way of saying, don't get caught up in the Jewish movement against Rome. You've got a different perspective on this. So, yes, you won't always be able to obey, and they didn't, but on the whole, you should respect authority. Start from that assumption. I won't go into that again, but we looked at that last week. Then he looked at slaves, and slaves suffer. Peter doesn't like slavery any more than anybody else does, but it's part of the system. So he's being realistic, and he talks to slave, and he said this, I'll read it again, verse 18, slaves, accept the authority of your masters with all, and I explain phobos, with all fear, but I think it's fear of the Lord. So while your ultimate obedience is to God, while you are aware of that, yes, be accept the authority of your masters within that enormous limit that your first focus, of course, is on obedience to God. And if there's a clash, well, you know what you've got to do. Not only those who are kind and gentle, and he wishes they all were, but we're not, but also those who are harsh. You know, if they can get freed, go for it. If they can escape and not get killed, there's nothing wrong with that either. But if they're there and they happen to have a harsh master and he's treating them badly, what are they going to do? They try and run away, they'll get crucified. So they might be stuck there, as we're often stuck in situations in our life which we can't realistically get out of. Well, it's a credit to you if, being aware of God, you endure pain while suffering unjustly. If you endure when you're beaten for doing wrong, well, what credit is that? But if you endure when you do right and suffer for it, you have God's grace, charis. God's grace is there with you. So don't despair. For to this you've been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you could follow in his steps. That took us last week to a long meditation on suffering in Jesus' life and suffering in our own. Peter now goes on. He committed no sin, and no deceit was in his mouth. You're going to see all the way through here, there's a reference to a beautiful poem, which I'm going to read for you in a moment, from the book of Isaiah. It's one you know very well from Good Friday. But just see the references here. That actually should be verse 9 there, not verse 4. So, he committed no sin, and no deceit was in his mouth. When he was abused, he did not return abuse. So watch Jesus on the cross and see this. When he suffered, he didn't threaten. When he entrusted himself, or rather, he entrusted himself to the one who judges justly, into your hands I commend my spirit. He himself bore our sins. He bore us with love, and we're sinners, so he loved us even with the weight of sin on us. He loved us while we were sinners, and in a sense, therefore, if we wish, loves us out of sin. In his body on the cross, so that free from sins, we might live for righteousness, realizing we don't need sin, we need love, and here's Jesus loving us, so we give sin away for love. And they're freed from it. And we want to follow Jesus along the path that he led. Well, if we want to follow him, we have to follow him. We can't hold both. By his wounds you've been healed, for you were going astray like sheep. But now you've returned to the shepherd and guardian of your souls. Obviously, Peter is full of the scriptures, as every young Jewish boy and girl would have been. That was their only literature. That was their only schooling. It's the only thing they read or heard was the scriptures in the synagogue. That was their education. So he's full of it, clearly, as was Jesus. And here he is. I'll show you now. I'll just take the time, if I may, to read you that beautiful poem. He doesn't quote it exactly, but this is where he's getting all his images from, and he's directing the readers back to it. And it's worth reading just for its own beauty. It's Isaiah chapter 52, verse 13, through to chapter 53, verse 12. It's written during the exile by this anonymous prophet whose writings were placed in the scroll of Isaiah, hence the reference, though they don't come from the prophet Isaiah. It's 150 years later. But he's writing in the spirit of Isaiah, and he's dreaming, not just dreaming, he's already seen the Persian Cyrus, who all the cities are opening their gates to Cyrus because they're sick of the Babylonian rule, which was much more oppressive, and Cyrus was allowing people to go back from free to, out of prison and whatever, exile into their own country and worship their own gods. So knowing this, the news has already reached Babylon that this is happening. So the prophet, filled with this knowledge, is excited because he knows that if Cyrus comes and takes Babylon, the capital of the Babylonian Empire, and in fact Cyrus did without a war, they just threw their gates open to him and the leader fled. We've had a bit of that in modern history in certain places. Didn't that happen in the Philippines and a few other places? So he can see that this is going to mean, so he started to think, what are we going to do when we go back? What kind of leader do we need? We've got to learn by our mistakes. 50 years ago, the city was destroyed, the temple was destroyed, the king was taken into exile. Why? We got it all wrong. We went into political power, etc., etc. So he's dreaming, in a way, that's probably an all right word, of the kind of leader they needed to take them back. And he'd have to be someone who'd suffered, because they've all suffered, but out of suffering had learnt something and wouldn't now repeat the mistakes of the past and set up in the new Jerusalem and the new temple, which they're hoping to rebuild, make the same mistakes again. Well, this is the kind of leader, the servant of the Lord. See, my servant will prosper. He shall be lifted up, rise, exalted to great heights. As the crowds were appalled on seeing him, so disfigured did he look that he seemed no longer human. So will the crowds be astonished at him, and kings stand speechless before him and witness something never heard before. Maybe he was expecting the young King Jeconiah, who's in exile, to lead them back. I don't know. We haven't got the evidence. In other words, he'd been taken out as a very young king, just during the siege of Jerusalem he was made king because his father was killed. Well, he was there as a boy. Now he's grown to a man. Is he expecting this king who's been humiliated in exile to lead them back? I don't know. Or is he expecting some prophet, some holy man there in exile to be leading? But through all the suffering, he's amazed at what people are going to see. This God is going to raise up this broken. Who could believe what we've heard? To whom has the power of Yahweh been revealed? Everyone thinks power of Yahweh is going to be given to the powerful, the strong, the brilliant, the military generals, the occupiers, the possessors. No, God is going to give the leadership to this humbled servant of the Lord. In a way, he's painting him a bit like Moses, the story of the Exodus. No more humble man than Moses has ever existed, says the book of Numbers. Like a sapling, he grew up in front of us, like a root in arid ground. Without beauty, without majesty, we saw him, no looks to attract our eyes, a thing despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering, a man to make people screen their faces. He was despised, and we took no account of him. And this is what Peter sees. Ours were the sufferings he bore, ours the sorrows he carried. No one is suggesting that Isaiah is thinking about Jesus. Of course he's not. He's writing the prophet here 500, 600 years earlier. But I know you can see why those who knew Jesus found this beautiful statement, how well it fitted. It doesn't fit perfectly, of course. You'll see that in a minute. But it's a beautiful poem from their tradition, and the church looks back to it and says, look, Jesus is exactly, read your Isaiah. He shouldn't have been condemned by the Jewish hierarchy, because look, he fulfills this beautifully. And he does, and we read it every Good Friday for that reason. We thought of him as someone punished, struck by God and brought low. Yet he was pierced through for our faults, crushed for our sins. On him lies a punishment that brings us peace, and through his wounds we are healed. Another image that Paul uses, Peter rather. We'd all gone astray like sheep. That's what he just said, didn't he? He's quoting it, really. We had all gone astray like sheep, each taking his own way. And Yahweh burdened him with the sins of us all. Harshly dealt with, he bore it humbly. He never opened his mouth. Like a lamb that led to the slaughterhouse, like a sheep that is dumb before its shearers, he never opened his mouth. By force and by law he was taken. Would no one plead his cause? Yes, he was torn away from the land of the living for our faults, struck down with death. They gave him a grave with the wicked, a tomb with the rich, though he'd done no wrong and there'd been no perjury in his mouth. Yahweh had been pleased to crush him with suffering. I hope as you read through there, you're twigging to the fact that in that world, there was an assumption which I certainly didn't grant last week. In fact, I took quite a contrary view, I hope with good reason. There's a kind of an assumption there that everything that happens must be God's will, as though God were controlling and running the world, you know? So if someone suffers, God must have planned it or willed it or allowed it. I took quite a different philosophical view of that, and it doesn't mean I'm right, but I just want to warn you that I did, and others do, of course, as well. Here's his conclusion. If he offers his life in expiation, he shall see his heirs. He shall have a long life, and through him what Yahweh wishes will be done. His soul's anguish over, he shall see the light and be content. The person about whom the prophet is writing is going to live a long life. He's going to have plenty of children. He's going to actually, though he's been taken to the very jaws of death, he's going to make it through. His soul's, he's not talking about the future life here. They didn't have that idea. His soul's anguish over, he shall see the light and be content. By his suffering shall my servant justify the many, taking their faults upon himself. Hence, conclusion, I will grant whole hordes for his tribute. He shall divide the spoil with the mighty, for surrendering himself to death and letting himself be taken for a sinner, while he was bearing the faults of many and praying all the time for sinners. I won't even attempt to go into that, or I'd spend all morning on it, just presenting it to you. But do you remember Luke's gospel? Luke is obviously caught, they all are, but Luke is calling on this, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Jesus kept on praying, says Luke, while he's on the cross. Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. And that poem is alluded to or quoted, I think it's 50 times in the New Testament. So clearly it was a favourite text, because it's so, not perfectly, but so beautifully picked up what they saw in Jesus. Well, that's Peter practically quoting it there.